The anger of the protesters is now matched by the anger of the riot police, who now understand the risks involved. Several of their colleagues were killed in the fighting yesterday.
These fierce clashes reported earlier today by the BBC appeared to shatter a brief truce in Ukraine's besieged capital of Kiev. Now CNN is reporting that at least 100 people have died and 500 have been injured since Thursday morning in Kiev. That is according to the head of the protesters' medical service. And Russian President Vladimir Putin is sending a representative to Kiev. The conflict first erupted in late November when the president of Ukraine flip-flopped on a plan to begin the process of joining the European Union. Joining us by phone is Serhiy Plohy. He's director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Joining us in the studio is retired U.S. Navy intelligence officer and currently a national security policy doctoral candidate at OSU's Glenn School of Public Affairs. He also served with the Ukraine Parliamentary Development Project for the United States Agency for International Development. Rudy Hightower, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne.
We know that the president, Viktor Yanukovych, his decision to renege on plans to establish closer ties with the European Union in late November triggered the demonstrations. Rudy Hightower, you just returned from Ukraine in January. Tell us what you saw when you arrived in early December, just days after the demonstrations started.
Well, when I actually got there, it was I was there for the peaceful portion of the Maidan protests. And like you said, President Viktor Yanukovych had rejected further ties with the EU. And there were quite a few people in the street when I got there on December 9th. It was in the, I would say, about the 40,000 level. But then by the time I left on the 24th of December, I was at the rally of 22 December. And that one was estimated to be about 100,000 people at that rally. And every weekend there would be a rally, and the numbers fluctuated, and of course it's just estimates. But I think it got to the high of 300,000 for one of the weekend rallies. And then, like I said, back down to 100,000 when I was actually there.
What were they like?
Oh, it was an incredible display of, one, peacefulness, and two, national pride. You would hear constant cheers. There's a slogan that was always thrown out there in Ukrainian, and it was, what did they say? It was hail to Ukraine, and then hail to the heroes. Okay. It'd be like we do OH, and then the crowd says IO. The speaker would say, you know, hail to Ukraine, and the crowd would say hail to the heroes. And it was a real unifying, like uplifting type of cheer, and that was throughout, you know, 24/7 throughout the, you know, day and night in the actual Maidan area. I was fortunate enough to have a hotel room at the 10th floor of Hotel Ukraine, which is right in the center section.
And we're hearing a lot about that on NPR and BBC this morning.
Right, and it's currently being used for, you know, medical facilities and journalists and such. But when I actually first checked in, you know, crazy as I am, you know, I was talking to the hotel desk clerk who tried to warn me about getting a room facing Maidan, because it was so energetic, it was so loud, it was it really, you know, something to witness. But I told her that no, I didn't want to face away. I wanted to be as high up as I could and face Maidan. And like I said, she was able to get me a 10th floor room. I kind of saw it all unfolding. I didn't get much sleep because it was a 24-hour celebration of like national unity, and there were religious speakers, there were pop divas. There were opera singers, rock stars playing 2 o'clock in the morning. It was just a real celebration of what the people were trying to do.
But nonetheless, there was also an undercurrent of anger that started this whole thing. Why was Serhiy Plohy, why was Ukraine President Yanukovych's decision to reverse policy regarding the European Union such a big deal?
Many people who joined protests on Maidan are protesting against corruption of the government.
Okay.
And there was that hope that once the Ukrainian government signs association agreement with European Union, that certain norms in terms of how business is conducted, in terms of the transparency, would be introduced in Ukraine. So that was a big hope that the country can start moving in the right direction. And the government fed into those hopes maybe for 1 year or something like that, promising to sign that. And then literally overnight changed its mind, and that what provoked protests. And again, I was there in December around the same time that Rudy was there. And again, it was very festive. It was like protests started like protests, but was really like a, I don't know, street party. And unfortunately, that all changed in January. And now in February, we see another wave of violence.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Rudy Hightower?
Yes, I'd like to reemphasize what Professor Plotkin said, that at the beginning, it was about the European integration, and the people that I talked to in the square were extremely upset with how abrupt the change was, because they were looking at expecting to sign the European agreement. But there was a shift even in December, from the beginning of December to where it was like, okay, we're protesting against and we're mad that we didn't make that connection more towards EU. But then with the, I think it was on the 11th of December, correct me if I'm wrong, Sergei, but the 11th of December.
Yes, it was around that time. December 10th, maybe, 10th and 11th. Yes.
Right, with the Russian economic bailout of $15 billion, that then it turned into people were upset, not because of just the EU piece, but they were looking at it as you know, we're going to change our future. This is not just about the EU integration. It's about our future. It's about our kids, our grandkids. It's about changing the entire government. And on more than one occasion, I heard people say, it's not a protest, but it's a revolution. And then even they would make the comment, we just want to live like normal people. And I didn't quite understand that. I talked to a few more people, and it was, I think they wanted just more like European standards, the less corruption being so endemic in the government, and just to be able to live like they see other people live in normal ways.
Go ahead, Suri.
Yeah, I can't agree more. That was really underlining sentiment on Maidan again through December and January. And the model for Ukraine is very much Poland and other neighbors to the West that joined European Union, and that was the model. The fact that Russia used all economic resources that it had first to discourage Ukraine to join European Union. They introduced sanctions against Ukrainian products in August, and then used that carrot of $15 billion. That also upset quite a few of people.
To stabilize their monetary system.
Right, because what happened partly because of the corruption of the government, that was actually the main reason. Ukraine at this point, by the end of the last year, found itself in a very difficult, not so much economic, but financial situation. The treasury was empty. And what the government was doing was really playing European Union against Russia, trying to get as much money as they could to keep going until the elections in 2015, new presidential elections. So that was the goal. And again, the people, or significant part of the people, just refused to go along and to play that kind of game.
There appears to be widespread support for the protesters, but there's also a great rift in this country between the East and the West. And you said that Ukraine was moving along the model of Poland and associating itself more with Western Europe. But between that, there's a difference between the East and the West in Ukraine and its history. Serhii Ploie, can you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. There is regionalism in Ukraine, and there are differences, cultural and historical and otherwise. But when it comes to the current crisis, I think that these differences are overstated.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we just on Ukrainian radio and TV, we heard the names of 11 or 12 people who were killed today early in the morning and who were identified. So they represent entire Ukraine, central Ukraine, western Ukraine, eastern Ukraine, a little bit more from the west. And what we see now is that this pro-Western and pro-European electorate in general is really mobilized. These are people on the streets. They're people who are prepared to die to achieve their overall goal of living, quote-unquote, in normal country and normal state. When it comes to the pro-Russian and more pro-Russian East, again, these people are not mobilized. We really don't. We are not sure what their position is. We know that in Ukraine, still between 30% and 38% of the population support current president. But again, because of the corruption of the government, they're not mobilized. They're not decisive in their actions. So the people who speak, the people who are on the streets, the people who are fighting there, are people who want in one way or another, again, not exactly to join European Union, but certainly to bring to their country the democratic norms and norms of conducting business that is characteristic of European Union. Of course, it's Europe has its own problems, but they're dwarfed by the problems that Ukraine has right now.
Okay, so CNN is now reporting that at least 100 people have died and 500 have been injured in Kiev since Thursday morning. That's according to the head of the protesters' medical service. And Russian President Vladimir Putin is sending a representative to Kiev. We'll continue our conversation about the violence and the protests in Ukraine when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we've been discussing the clashes between protesters and police in Ukraine. Still with us by phone is historian Serhii Plohy of Harvard. Also with us in the studio is National Security Policy doctoral candidate at OSU's Glenn School of Public Affairs, Rudy Hightower. Yesterday, President Obama commented on the U.S. and its allies and said that the allies will be monitoring the situation. We'll get to that in just a minute. But first, let's go back to the issue of regionalism and to the degree or not to which it is being played up in this conflict. Rudy Hightower?
Yes, I just wanted to concur with Professor Plotkin that I think that the difference between the East and West is being oversold. And really, it's three regions that you want to look at. East, West, and South.
Okay.
Along the Black Sea.
Why is it being oversold, do you think? Because it's simple?
Well, no, there are regional differences.
Okay.
And they're strong. And there's economic differences and there's industrial differences where a lot of the East is industrial and, a lot of the mining, manufacturing, and those kind of things. And the more historical, traditional, nationalistic influences and cultural things are in the
breadbasket part of the country.
No, those are in the West, but the breadbasket is right there in the middle, which is the real fertile soil. But there's also the South, which is Odessa, Mykolaiv, Kherson, and then also the peninsula of Crimea. So there's three distinct kind of regions, but they're not in this conflict breaking out as exactly this is for the government and this side is for the protesters, because there's protests happening in Kharkiv and even in other, Dnepropetrovsk and other eastern and southern cities.
Okay.
And daily I talk to friends and colleagues in Odessa and other cities in Ukraine via Skype. And a lot of times what the impression is that even in those southern and eastern regions, they're not happy with what the government has done, and especially at the point that it is now with bloodshed of Ukrainians.
Rudy Hightower, what the protests are called the Euromaidan movement. What does that mean?
Well, the euro is just the connection to Europe.
Okay.
But Maidan is the
Maidan. Okay.
Yeah, Maidan, right. And they just kind of put it together in a nice, you know, way to frame the protest. But it's right there in that center section, that main independent square is, I believe, how it translates. Maidan, it translates to independent square.
Let's listen to the president now speaking about the U.S. and its allies and how they are monitoring the situation now.
We are going to be watching very carefully, and we expect the Ukrainian government to show restraint, to not resort to violence in dealing with peaceful protesters. We've said that we also expect peaceful protesters to remain peaceful, and we'll be monitoring very carefully the situation, recognizing that along with our European partners and the international community, there will be consequences if people step over the line.
Serhii Plohii, we've heard though there will be consequences line before. The president mentioned that. Realistically, what might this mean if other nations get involved, especially the United States?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that was already announced was that 20 members of the current administration, Ukrainian government, their visas were withdrawn, so they can't visit the United States of America. But more importantly, it's the issue of the accounts of members of the government, but also the businessmen and especially Ukrainian oligarchs who support the government. They use Western European and partly American financial system to conduct their business. That's where they put their money. And Europe and West in general is also a very important market for those businessmen. So that is something that is probably much more effective in terms of influencing current situation in Ukraine and the way of thinking of business elites and also political elites around current president, Viktor Yanukovych.
We were just talking about China the other day and how, yes, the global economy is affecting everything. You can't just be one or the other anymore because of, in Ukraine, the oligarchs, for one thing. They have big businesses to support. To what extent, let's talk about Ukraine's dependence on Russia for just a moment and how that's evolved and been maintained over time. Rudy Hightower, Vladimir Putin, he's put forth sanctions, but also, as Serhii mentioned earlier, some carrots.
All right, right. And it's a dependency between Ukraine and Russia that will never go away. It's historic, it's a cultural link, and, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to argue that it should go away. It is centuries and centuries old. But the thing right now in today's world is it's so dependent on economics, not just the language, not just the cultural things, the foods and the history. And it generally revolves around natural gas and the flow of natural gas from Russia and some of the other republics through Ukraine to Eastern and Western Europe. So it's a huge issue, both from the energy resources that stay in Ukraine and dictate Ukraine's economy and how it's going to move, and also impacting the European energy resources. So I think that it's the dependency. Russia always has the upper hand, and Ukraine is always kind of scrambling to get the best price they can for their own natural gas and then also for storage and transit rates. But Ukraine will never get really out of that connection and that dependency on Russia for that until they get to the point where they can
afford to
get more energy self-sufficiency, whether mm-hmm. it's shale or some offshore resources or those kind of things. But the connection to Ukraine and Russia, once again, I think that's one of the things that people are thinking that, well, they're going to go to Europe and then disown or disavow any of their connection with Russia. And that is absolutely impossible because of the long shared border, the at least 1,500-year history between, you know, the countries, and even that Russia started historically in the area that is now Ukraine, Kiev and Rus.
Serhii Plohii, why then cannot Russia coexist with that kind of a situation, with Ukraine becoming closer with the UE the EU, pardon me, and also retain strong ties to Russia, which are necessary and desirable by many?
The story begins in 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union fell apart partly because Ukraine and Ukrainian elite at that time took the position that they didn't want to be part of that union anymore. So it was the referendum in Ukraine in December, on December 1st of 91, that killed the union. And from that time on, Russia's strategic vision and vision for its foreign policy was to establish a sort of sphere of influence in the post-Soviet space. And Ukraine, as the largest after Russia post-Soviet country, is of course key for that vision. That's why any movement on part of Ukraine toward West, either toward NATO or toward European Union, is considered by Russia as basically Western encroachment on Russia's turf. And that certainly doesn't sit well with many in Ukraine. And we see what happens now, what happens today, is part of that displeasure and basically rejection, this idea that any Ukrainian neighbors, and Russia in particular, should dictate Ukraine what to do and what not to do.
We have a tweet from journalist Pavel Sheremet, who says the EU foreign ministers have emerged looking gloomy from the meeting with President Yanukovych and left without saying a word to journalists. It's a bad sign. That's a tweet from journalist Pavel Sheremet. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Rudy Hightower, that just happened. They just left. Everyone was waiting. There's no word now. Can you tell us a little bit or talk about President Yanukovych and what he's like and what these meetings might be like?
Well, I can't really say, you know, what he's feeling and those kind of things. But as a president, President Yanukovych, I would imagine, is feeling that his world is kind of collapsing because his power base is becoming more and more reduced. And that is the only thing that he pretty much has left. If the oligarchs are feeling pressure to either abandon or to at least find another candidate so that the bloodshed stops and that their visas aren't restricted and their financial assets aren't restricted, then that's another piece of his power base that's being reduced. Also, I think I read today that the his handpicked mayor of Kiev has resigned because of the bloodshed. So I would imagine that Viktor Yanukovych right now is feeling that maybe a little sense of desperation that it's either now or never for me to either squash this protest or somehow try to get out. You know, I'd have to advocate my actual power as a president. And I don't think he's ready to do that or that he feels that he really should do that.
Serhiy Plohy?
Again, I completely agree with Mr. Hightower. Yanukovych is in a difficult position. His vision was back in the fall of 1991 that he would keep this balancing act between Russia and European Union, and then at the end, actually, when he said no to EU association with European Union, that's what triggered the event. So this is certainly wasn't his plan. He also now has problems with his own faction in the parliament. And one of the explanations of this spike in violence the day before yesterday and then today is that the president can't control his faction anymore. What is happening today, right now, while Yanukovych was meeting with the foreign ministers of France, Germany, and Poland, the session of the parliament was opened, and I am not sure whether they have a quorum there, so more than half parliamentarians, but certainly they got there with the agenda that is not exactly a president's agenda. So on the agenda is a formation of a new government, return to the constitution of 2004 that gives more rights to the prime minister, and prime minister would be more dependent on the parliament than on the president. So there are also defections, within his own faction. The acting mayor of Kiev is one example, and there are more examples like that. People are leaving the ruling party.
Rudy Hightower, why did the Constitution change in 2004 in the first place?
Well, it was a move to try to consolidate power, and it's one of the principles of democratization, where it's the three pieces are the political actors, civil society, and the institutions. And once you actually get more of the institutions in, I don't want to say in your pocket, but under your control, then you can actually impact more things, and you can be a lot tougher to institute reforms that they all thought were necessary.
Okay.
So significant economic reforms were needed, and they're still needed in Ukraine. But to effect those kind of reforms, you need to have your party pretty much controlling the legislative process and some of those institutions, like the parliament of Verkhovna Rada. Right? So once Viktor Yanukovych and the Party of Regions was able to have that supermajority, they were able to push through reforms and plans that they thought would help with the reforms that were needed.
Now, you talked about factions, Serhii Ploiy, among the government. There are also factions among the protesters.
Absolutely.
Tell us about the different groups among the protesters.
Well, at the beginning, there were three main groups, and all of them were and are represented in the parliament. So the most numerous and in the parliament group is the party which is called Fatherland, or Batykivshchina, and the leader of that party was imprisoned by the current government. It was 2 years ago. Her name is Yulia Tymoshenko, so she is still in prison right now.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the orientation of that party, I would say it's more liberal, national liberal, something along those lines. The second most influential group is the group led by it seems to me he is current as well, a heavyweight champion, boxer Klitschko. And this is a centrist group, basically. The smallest faction was the faction of the Svoboda Party, Liberty Party, and this is a nationalist party based mostly in western part of Ukraine. As things moved at Maidan with protests, from peaceful protests toward this confrontation with the authorities and violence, another group emerged, which is called now the Right Sector, and this basically are people who are part of the self-defense of the Maidan, who are actually engaged in all those, it's almost now military actions. And it's impossible now to make any deal with the government to conduct effective negotiations without taking into account this force that was born out of events on Maidan. So it started with three major factions working together, and they still continue working together in the parliament and when it comes to negotiations with the president and his people. But by now there are four, and this so-called self-defense or right sector group, it's gaining in its influence.
Rudy Hightower?
Yeah, I'd like to add that I think Professor Plotsky hit the nail on the head with what is really now the danger, is that there's a faction within the faction, and it's hard for the opposition to control that faction, just like there's a faction within the government factions, and it's hard for the government to control that. So it's not so much that this is all just about the government and the opposition. Those sub-factions need to be controlled, or need to have listen to their leadership and be able to put down arms and stop and let the next step proceed, which would be dialogue and some kind of political resolution.
Who gets in those rooms, though?
In
those kind of dialogues, what?
Well, that's normally the people that the leaders that you'll see in the news. It'll
okay.
be the three opposition leaders, also Yanukovych and his main leaders. But I'd have to defer to Professor Plotsky on the leadership of Right Sector and whether or not they're in any official negotiations, as opposed to maybe when the opposition meets amongst themselves, maybe that's when their issues are brought up, the Right Sector issues are brought up, or that they're tried, there's an attempt to try to control the actions of Right Sector.
Well, also, Serhii, as far as the Right Sector goes, is that the group that's being blamed for some of the kind of rogue violence going on in Kiev and in other places?
Well, they're blamed for getting engaged in these confrontations with the riot police without authorization of the official leaders of opposition. Or the government blames them for provoking, for example, riot police and things like that. When it comes to groups that are shooting at people in Kyiv or get engaged in all sorts of acts of violence outside of Maidan, these are, at least according to the media coverage, these are the groups of thugs that are hired by the government support of the riot police to fight against Maidan, and then it's either the government loses control over them or basically the government tries to create this chaos and then use this as a pretext or excuse to introduce a state of emergency, or as yesterday they came up with that name, anti-terrorist action. So again, the negotiators at the top increasingly are losing control over their troops on the ground.
Okay, so the latest we heard is the EU foreign ministers have emerged from the meeting with President Yanukovych and left without saying a word to journalists. As a journalist Pavel Sheremet said in his tweet, it's a bad sign. And in the studio with me today is retired U.S. Navy intelligence officer and currently with OSU's Glenn School of Public Affairs. He also served at the Ukraine Parliamentary Development Project for the United States Agency for International Development, Rudy Hightower, and also Serhii Plohy. He's director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we've been discussing the clashes between protesters and police in Ukraine. Still with us by phone is Serhii Plohy of Harvard, also with us from the Glenn School of Public Affairs at Ohio State. Is Rudy Hightower. Just hours after a truce was declared, clashes between anti-government protesters and security forces broke out in Ukraine's capital. From Kiev, NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson reported on violence in the area this morning.
One of the speakers on the main stage here is telling protesters to watch out for snipers from the rooftop. The fighting is going on, I would say, maybe about a half mile or even less from where I'm standing. I can see the smoke billowing. And what seems to have happened overnight is that the protesters have taken back the October Palace, which was a building which the police had taken back on Tuesday. So they've actually managed to push police out of Independence Square.
Serhii Plohy, can you give us a sense of where Independence Square is in the city and what it means that the protesters regained control of it?
Well, it is in city's downtown and close to what is called the government block or government quarter. And what we saw in the last few days were the attempts of the protesters from the Maidan or Independence Square in downtown to get to the closer to the building of the parliament, government building, and building of the presidential administration. And that's where basically this street fights are going on now, and were going on for the last few days. So we see either the riot police moving closer toward the center of the Maidan or Independence Square, and the protesters trying to protect the turf, or the protesters are switch from defense to defense and try to get closer to the presidential administration. So it's all within basically roughly 1 mile distance, one from another.
Rudy Hightower, did you want to add anything to that?
The only thing I'd add is more of a personal comment that as a retired military man, I mean, it's really tragic and painful to hear these things now being described in military terms. that it's like war type terms of right. capturing, recapturing, gaining ground, and snipers from Bruce and those kind of things. And we'd hope that we can somehow get it to the point where it's back to dialogue and that control is established on both sides of those subsectors so that there's some dialogue and that there's some time can expire so that compromises and things can kind of be worked out. But it's just really painful to hear this whole thing being described in such militaristic terms, especially since I was there like just in December when it was much more peaceful.
It is painful, if I can add to that. Mm-hmm. And it started really as a protest of students and youth, and it was festive, mm-hmm. and there was songs and dances, and poets were reading their poems, and mm-hmm. the Maidan, the protesters, they have their own library. They were asking people to donate, and it all now deteriorated into this military fight and struggle, and it is terrible. And again, the government, in my opinion, is the main culprit, and the government is responsible for what is going on.
According to the BBC, the French and Polish foreign ministers have tweeted that they have finished their meeting with President Yanukovych and are going to have another meeting with the opposition to test a proposed agreement. The French foreign minister said that their discussion with the president lasted 5 hours. So that's significant, I would imagine. 5 hours is a good piece of time. Once again, CNN is reporting that at least 100 people have died and 500 have been injured since Thursday morning there. That is according to the head of the protesters' medical service. You both talked about the pain of hearing these things in military terms. And I think about the more people die, the more grudge becomes part of the feeling in a situation like that.
Absolutely. And that may even contribute to the lengthening of the conflict, because yeah. it may get to the point where the government and President Yanukovych is so desperate that he's thinking that, well, even if I abdicate power, then I'm going to now be prosecuted, at the highest level because there's so much bloodshed. Yulia Tymoshenko was convicted and put in jail for 7 years for an abuse of power over a treaty. Now there's this many Ukrainians killed, and it's on his watch. It'd be his responsibility. He may even hold on longer to think that and be more desperate that I can't give up power because, the option to me if I resigned wouldn't be a nice, peaceful one.
Mm-hmm. And I believe one of the signs of that desperation is that mm-hmm. today the acting minister of Interior said that he gave an order for police to use live ammunition. So
right.
this is the new law in terms of that conflict. And again, most of the people who were killed or wounded today on Maidan were killed by the government snipers using live ammunition. It's terrible.
I read in the National Catholic Register yesterday that some 20,000 of the anti-government demonstrators, and of course that's really a small fraction now of who's out there, are supported by the Catholic Church. What has the role of religion played in the conflicts, whether it be it regional or the conflict at hand over time, Serhii Plohii?
Mm-hmm. Again, there are regional differences when it comes to religion in Ukraine. So central and eastern and southern part of Ukraine are traditionally Orthodox, and western parts, or at least some of those western parts, are Catholic. There is a Greek Catholic Church which follows Orthodox ritual but is in jurisdiction of Rome. But it doesn't look like that this differences between Catholic and Orthodox part matter at Maidan, because we see the representatives of both churches being on Maidan, pleading for peace, trying to be part of what is going on. And the Greek Catholic Church and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is under the jurisdiction of Kyiv, not under jurisdiction of Moscow, they opened their churches for the protesters, so they serve as makeshift hospitals and places where people get rest, get food. One of those major Orthodox buildings are really close to Maidan. at the St. Michael Cathedral, which is, again, where the Patriarch of Kyiv allowed protesters to stay. And further away is a Greek Catholic cathedral that also actually they have the same policy. Kyiv Patriarchate announced today that they don't pray for the government anymore. So this is as strong condemnation of the actions as one can imagine. Again, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church is not united, and most of the church is under Moscow Patriarchate, and that part of the church, as far as I know, didn't make any official statements apart from general appeals for peace.
Yeah,
and
I'd echo with what Sergei said, and I also witnessed a 2:30 in the morning demonstration on the Maidan of religious members and officials preaching and giving sermons, and with the large crowds, showing that the religious institutions are, or at least at that early peaceful part, were supporting what the people were actually trying to do. And if I can date myself, you know, in the way these kind of things play out, it reminded me a lot of People Power Revolution in the Philippines in 1986, where once Ferdinand Marcos lost some of his institutions, being the religion and the military and things, then everything collapsed all around him and he was forced to leave. And I was thinking that, you know, I had that same feeling when I was walking around Maidan, that the government here is losing not only just, you know, the people from any other region or whatever region, but he's also losing institutions, the civil society, the media, and the church.
Is Ukraine a per se religious country?
This is a very interesting and very difficult question to answer. So it was much more religious than the rest of the Slavic Soviet Union. So 60% of all Orthodox churches of the Soviet Union were in Ukraine. More than 60% of Protestant membership of Protestant churches. So it was much more religious than maybe the rest of the Union, with the exception of Central Asian republics. But that being said, Ukraine lived, most of Ukraine lived through 70 years of state atheism. And there is this return to religion in a major way, but it's not maybe the kind of religiosity that you would expect here in the United States. So it's people's knowledge of religion is quite limited yet,
because they have to be reeducated.
Reeducated, exactly. And again, when it comes to the Orthodox churches, the situation is more or less the same as it is, let's say, somewhere in the Balkans or in Russia, that people not necessarily go to church every Sunday. So Easter and Christmas would be the two major holidays when they would go there and manifest their belonging to religion. But when it comes to the situation like that, when it's war, when it's dead, when it's crisis, of course, more and more people turn toward religion, and it's difficult to overestimate the importance of that the religion plays today, and priests in particular, who go to Maidan, who support people there, who talk to them, who conduct services, and so on and so forth.
Right, and although the Ukrainians are being reintroduced to religion after their Soviet period, the history of religion in Ukraine is extensive. I mean, there's 1,000-year-old churches that are in Ukraine. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. And again, they're in close neighborhood of the Independence Square Maidan, and the church that I mentioned to you, the Orthodox Church that serves as a sanctuary to people on Maidan, that was the church that originally comes from the 12th century, then was blown up by the Bolsheviks back in the 1930s and rebuilt after 1991 according to its original model. So that's a symbol of return of Christianity, and not just return of any kind of Christianity, but with this very deep roots in the region.
I would imagine, given that long pre-Soviet era history of religion in Ukraine, that it was probably pretty hard to completely suppress it during those 70 years. Was there an underground movement of religion there?
It's in western parts of Ukraine that were incorporated into the Soviet Union fully, really only after World War II. There was underground Greek Catholic Church was there and was in catacombs and survived and then came back during Gorbachev years of perestroika and glasnost. It was registered again officially in 1989. When it comes to eastern parts of Ukraine, you had a very strong underground Protestant movement and Baptist in particular. There was an entire faction that didn't recognize the government and government regulations. So yes, we see in Ukraine this more than in any other part maybe of the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, this existence of church structures outside of the government and against clearly expressed and enforced will of the government.
Rudy Hightower, I mentioned earlier that you served with the Ukraine Parliamentary Development Project for the United States Agency for International Development. Can you tell us about what the prospects were then for parliamentary development, how you see it has played out over the past years and what you make of it now, given this crisis?
Right. Well, that actual project was a 20-year USAID project, which mm-hmm. is an incredible amount of time for a USAID project. And it was started by our former director of the John Glenn School, Dr. Charles Wise, back in, I want to say, 1994, when he would actually go with friends and actually interact with parliamentarians and leaders of the Ukrainian government. And because it was such a long-term project, it existed throughout different administrations and different types of administrations.
There and here.
Well, yeah, there and here, but mainly there because it was implemented there in Ukraine. Okay. And then eventually we had offices in both Kiev and Simferopol down in the Crimea. And the real advantage of the PDP, Parliamentary Development Project, was that we would do an analysis and provide products, but we wouldn't provide recommendations.
Okay.
So we wouldn't tell the Ukrainians what to do. They would come to us and say, well, we need to know some more about personal property rights or gender issues or those things. And we do some analysis, not just look at a U.S. model, but look at a Swedish model or how the Spain do autonomous regions and things. And then we would present that to the Ukrainians and they'd see whether or not that fit their model. And it allowed for a real good dialogue and a real good connection between the civil servants and civil society. So it was successful. The project just ended, I want to say, the end of August of last year.
Okay.
And we didn't foresee any of the things that are happening now. I think it'd be real hard-pressed for people to have really foreseen what's happened now because I was agreeing with Sergey, but I think there was a lot of misjudgment on the part of the government in what they could do. It got to a point where they thought that they could do anything they want, and that the Ukrainian people wouldn't stand up, but so much. But the Ukrainian people are strong, resilient, you know, tough people, and even in their words in their national anthem are, Ukraine's not dead yet. So they are tough people, and when the government did some of these things to the Maidan protesters, I don't think the government anticipated that the response would be that strong and that determined. So the PDP program, while it was successful in instituting and helping with civil society and building certain projects, we didn't really foresee the things that happened with Maidan.
Well, Rudy Hightower, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Once again, Rudy Hightower, he is a retired U.S. Navy intelligence officer and currently a national security policy doctoral candidate at OSU's Glenn School of Public Affairs. And Serhiy Plohy, thank you so much as well for joining us.
You're welcome.
Serhiy Plohy, he's director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard University. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.